Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Twitter permanently banned President Trump's account, citing policy violations after the deadly insurrection in the U.S. Capitol last week. Other social media sites followed suit. After the ban, the conservative platform Parler saw the number of users spike until Google, Apple, and Amazon took it offline. On Monday, Parler sued Amazon. Natasha Tiku covers tech culture for The Washington Post. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with Twitter banning President Trump. He's violated Twitter policy before. How did Twitter explain why this was the tipping point?
Right. So what the company said is that they cited their rules around glorification of violence, and they made a forward-looking argument. They said that it was possible that his tweets could inspire others to replicate the kind of violent acts we saw at the Capitol last week.
Has there been any repercussion for Twitter from Trump's followers after the ban?
There's certainly been a massive backlash, and from conservatives, from conservative lawmakers, from users who argue that this is a First Amendment issue and illustrates, you know, some of the dangers that we've heard from both parties about the concentration of power in big tech and their ability to silence voices.
And how does Twitter defend itself against the argument of First Amendment, a breach of the First Amendment?
Well, they, as a private company, they have no obligation to adhere to the First Amendment. It is, they have in the past described themselves as the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party, but, you know, that's really just kind of marketing and rhetoric. So they are well within their rights to shut off users to the amplification that their platform provides.
And the president tried to use the official POTUS account after the ban on his personal account, Real Donald Trump, but Twitter stopped that too. Did he do something on the POTUS account that called for a ban, or did they just want to cut him off at the knees there?
Right. Well, Twitter's policy is once you've been banned, using your alternative accounts to continue to post is a violation of their standard policy.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Washington Post tech culture reporter Natasha Tiku about how social media has responded and what kind of pushback they're getting to how they're responding to the president during these last few weeks of his presidency. Trump has been quiet online since then. It's bizarre, frankly. I mean, we've kind of all gotten trained to check our Twitter and see what the president said at 3:00 in the morning. But in his statement last Friday, he said he'd have a big announcement soon. What more do we know about that?
We are expecting a big announcement. He has said he will not be silenced. What we are expecting is that he is planning on launching his own kind of alternative social media platform. Some of his supporters have teased announcements on some of the smaller alternative platforms, like a Parler alternative such as Gab or MeWe. He has the ability to still go on Fox News or any other news channels, and certainly to use his podium at the White House to make announcements. So we are expecting strong condemnation of Silicon Valley's responses over the past week, and also for him to promote an alternative.
It's interesting how this relationship has devolved over time. He's been ticked off at Silicon Valley for a while now. Again, they didn't ban him until just this point. So it's not doesn't appear to be retribution for his ongoing criticism of the big tech companies.
Oh, certainly not at all. And in fact, it's important to contextualize these recent actions are really just enforcing pre-existing policies, all the way back to around December 2015, when Trump was making, before he was even elected president, when he was making statements about Muslims and about immigrants. Those statements According to the Washington Post reporting, executives at Facebook, for example, decided violated their terms and their existing rules around hate speech and harassment. However, they chose to give him an exception to those rules, citing kind of crafting an argument around newsworthiness that allowed him to continue to post. So what they're doing now is really just enforcing some of those rules, as you've noted, like very, very late in the game. So it's certainly not, it would be very hard to make the argument that it was retribution for 4 years of commentary, especially when they've been getting criticism from both Republicans and Democrats.
What is the likelihood that he launches his own platform? I mean, you still need to have somebody market it, to put it out there. And if they've already dropped Parler, what are his chances?
Well, I think the likelihood is probably pretty strong, right? Like we've seen rumors and reports about Trump TV and Jared Kushner, his interest in putting together an alternative media platform. I think that I can imagine that based on the reasons that Parler was removed from the App Store by Google and Apple, that it allows room for the platform to come back on. What they said was that it wasn't enforcing, it didn't have strong enough content moderation around incitements to violence. So that's something that the company could counter. And it's not, the response that we've seen from tech companies is not typical. Like, they haven't said anything about that policy not being reversed if the company changed its practices.
I've been curious if anyone else of note has been banned in connection with the insurrection last week. Any of Trump's kids, any of that, anyone connected to him in that way?
Right. So actually the way the tech companies have now widened their approach, especially with Trump leaving office so soon, I think people rightly interpret the censoring of him as, revoking his user, his ability to amplify his posts on their platform as largely symbolic. So the direction the companies have gone is to look at those larger networks of misinformation. So for example, Twitter recently took down 70,000 QAnon-related conspiracy theory accounts that were spreading misinformation. Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer yesterday, talked about the company's actions against Stop the Steal campaigns that have spread misinformation around the election results. So that's really the direction that we're seeing companies going. I think what they're thinking about now at this late date is stopping further acts of potential violence.
Right. Twitter's announcement specifically mentioned a secondary attack on the Capitol and state Capitol buildings on January 17th or in or around that date. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be an issue for Twitter at this point, at least.
Yes, certainly. And I think that, based on the kinds of posts that we are still seeing online, that is an immediate concern for law enforcement officials, like you said, not just in the Capitol, but in various state capitals as well.
So Google and Apple blocked Parler from its app stores. Amazon just took it offline, prompting, complaints that liberal tech companies were censoring conservatives. Parler sued Amazon on Monday. Again, what's the basis of that suit?
Right. So the complaint alleges a breach of contract for not giving Parler 30 days notice. Parler uses Amazon's Amazon Web Services, so it's a cloud hosting platform. It also alleged that it was an antitrust violation and that it interfered with Parler's relationship with its users.
And Amazon has responded how?
Amazon, denies the allegations, basically. I think that they feel like they have a strong leg to stand on, again, as a private company.
Okay. What about, though, that 30-day notice? I mean, if there's a contract and a breach of contract, that's something, isn't it?
I mean, I think Parler is certainly going to make that argument. And I think that we've seen just in the actions of the past week, there is a massive difference between not allowing amplification on a platform versus the kind of the way that removing an app from the app stores can kneecap discovery. And then, you know, one level further up the tech stack, the way that, you know, Amazon's actions actually took it offline.
The criticism of big tech is that it has too much power. It's largely unregulated. That's a choice that Congress has made, you know, really, and that lawmakers until recently haven't shown much interest in clamping down on it. What is your sense about the incoming Biden administration and how they might manage things differently?
The Biden administration has already, you know, made statements that it plans on taking potential action against Section 230 of the Communications and Decency Act. And that's been a bedrock law for internet companies because it exempts them from liability for content posted online by users. So, you know, they don't have the same concerns that news organizations like yours and mine have. And it's really allowed them to scale up to a these massive levels. And, you know, there has been, even outside the Biden administration, a lot of talk around Section 230. And also we've seen some recent antitrust enforcement. So again, much like the tech companies, it's really enforcing the laws that are already on the books.
It is what the president has tweeted about too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Section 230.
Certainly. These are bipartisan concerns. You've seen in the hearings when Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey go up to Washington that they are getting hard questions from both parties.
Facebook has blocked the president on its platforms, including Instagram, until his term ends January 20th. So what's the logic behind that?
The logic behind that is they're concerned about, because of threats of violence, you know, in the coming weeks, potentially during the inauguration. However, Sheryl Sandberg, Facebook's chief operating officer, just said yesterday in a video interview that they have no plans on reinstating Trump's account. So They're really not using clear language here. You know, what's the difference between a permanent suspension and a lifetime ban? But neither Twitter nor Facebook is saying that they have plans to reinstate his accounts.
Gotcha. Natasha Tiku, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Natasha Tiku is tech culture reporter for The Washington Post. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This week, the Ohio Invention League kicks off its celebration of Ohio Kid Inventors, and all of that culminates in a National Kid Inventor Day on Sunday. Magana Boda is a high school freshman at Olentangy High School and the inventor of Bright Right. She will represent Ohio at the National Convention. Which Olentangy High School, Magana?
I'm at the Olentangy Maine High School.
Maine High School. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
You bet. Let's see. Soham Joshi is a high school junior at Columbus Academy, an inventor of a robotic glove that can teach sign language. He will represent the state at the national convention. Welcome, Soham, to the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And Abby Fisher is the programming director for the Ohio Invention League. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Anne.
Abby, before we have the students explain their inventions, give us an idea of the Ohio Invention League's work and, you know, how the, I guess, pandemic has changed this week of celebration, right?
Well, the Ohio Invention League's Invention Convention program has been in Ohio. This is our 28th year. We've been celebrating Kid Inventor Day, presented by AT&T, at the State House for the past 4 years. The first year, it was five kids at the State House. We went around, saw the senators and House reps in their offices. Then it moved into a larger event that has taken place in the atrium and the rotunda the past 2 years. This year, because of the pandemic, we are celebrating virtually with AT&T through a video series showcasing kid inventors, Ohio legislators, and then on the weekend, we'll be doing compilation videos of many, many student inventors throughout the state of Ohio and sharing and celebrating their achievements in invention.
So started with five students, how many this year?
This year we have recognition going out from the Ohio State House to 83 students. So we've really grown.
Yeah. So the robotic glove that you and your teammate developed can help teach sign language. Can you describe what it looks like and how you use it?
Yeah. So like you mentioned, the glove is designed to teach those who are either deaf, blind, or both deaf and blind sign language. And so as you can probably imagine, someone who is both deaf and blind communicating for them is very difficult. And so what we did is we created a robotic glove that can fit on your hand. And it uses a combination of motors and strings to pull your fingers into certain locations. And then based on that, you're able to make different signs. And so what we do is we have a full 360 degree rotation of both the elbow and the hand and the fingers in order to create all these complicated signs in sign language.
So you put the glove on and it makes your fingers move.
Yeah, and so we chose to do that because we found that our research has also shown that the tactile sense is really important. And so we wanted to create something that people could actually touch and feel. And so by creating a glove that people can put on their hand, they're actually able to remember the signs much better because their hand is actually moving because of the glove.
Magana, a neighbor's apple tree inspired you to create Bright Ripe. Tell us about Bright Ripe.
So right now there are many, many, like millions of apples that are getting improperly harvested every year. And I didn't know that was that big of a problem. So I felt like I had to do something about it. And my invention makes it easier to just identify which crops are exactly, like which ones are ripe and ready to be harvested.
What do you mean by improperly harvest? You mean they're being picked too early?
Yeah, they're either picked too early or picked too late because the apple orchards, they're really large and there isn't, right now there are prototypes for robotic ways to just grab the apples, but there isn't a way to exactly identify which ones to pick. So they're either being picked way too early or too late, and that's causing a lot of loss.
So how does your device work?
So there's, it sounds really simple, but there's a lot that goes back into it. So there's an LED that shines onto a fruit, and then based on how much light the fruit absorbs, it also reflects an amount back. And there's something called a photoresistor, and it adds a specific amount of resistance into the circuit. And I've set it to be that if the fruit is ripe enough, then a second or indicating LED would light up. And if the fruit isn't ripe enough, then it just won't light up.
What is it about the light that's detecting ripeness?
It's because if the fruit is riper, it will absorb more light. So okay. It'll give, like, it will make the indicating LED light up. But if the fruit is unripe, then it won't absorb as much light.
And how do you see this being applied to a big orchard?
Well, I was actually planning on making my prototype work with the prototypes that are actually put into place right now.
Okay.
So instead of just picking it, it would also know which ones to pick.
Okay. I wanted to ask you both, you know, everything, it seems like every single show I do now is punctuated by because of the pandemic. Okay, so I'm wondering about you. Would you, how did the staying home maybe a hybrid education process for you this year, how did it affect, Soham, your inventiveness?
Yeah, I think one way it affected it was one thing we really wanted to do with the glove was go and test it on actual on individuals who wanted to learn sign language. But obviously, due to the pandemic, we couldn't do that. And I think the process of really testing our invention and putting it out there for people to see, for people to feel and understand how it works, was really hindered by the pandemic.
And so how did you test it? I mean, what did you do instead?
Yeah, so what we actually did is we created an artificial intelligence algorithm where we inputted all the signs in sign language, and we inputted videos of them. And then what the algorithm did is it looked at our glove and it looked at various key points on the glove and then mapped that to the actual sign language performed by a professional. And what we found is that from that testing that we conducted, we found that our glove is probably 90 to 94% effective in teaching people these signs.
Okay, so I'm visualizing this now. Now I think I'm starting to get it. So somebody who can neither hear nor see puts on the gloves and they can maybe write something out in advance, and then the gloves make their fingers move to so that somebody else can read what they have to say or see what they have to say.
Yeah, so for people who are specifically deaf and blind, usually they aren't born both deaf and blind. They're usually born one or neither. And over the course of their lifetime, so probably into their teenage years, is when they lose both senses completely. So they have some understanding of language. Okay. And so they usually end up learning Braille or some or other sort of communication before that in order to prepare. But once they do go both deaf and blind, then sign language is the main form of communication. And so what our glove does is that since they already know Braille, it tells them what word they're learning in Braille. And then from there, it'll work on doing the signs so that they can connect what the glove is doing in the sign language to what they already know and what they've already seen.
I always like to ask, I mean, I always love this segment. I get to talk to real inventors. So, what have you learned? I mean, in the process of all of this, what's the weakness of your invention that you want to keep working on?
Yeah, I think it's probably the usability for all types of people, because lots of different people want to learn sign language. So whether that be people in their 30s or that can be children. And so probably the biggest weakness in our solution is making this glove a one-size-fits-all kind of model where everyone can use it rather than just a certain part, like subset of people.
Like, I've always wanted to learn sign language. I could use it to learn sign language.
Yeah, yeah. Huh.
Magana, we talked about a neighbor's apple tree inspired you. You said you were, chagrined to learn about how many apples are improperly harvested. How many apples are, how big of a problem is this?
Oh, there are, like, millions of apples. It's a lot, and it's causing, like, millions of dollars of loss to the agricultural industry and the merchandise industry, and it's just a huge chain.
Okay, and I want, and as well for you, how did the pandemic affect your inventiveness and how you did this?
Yeah, so over the summer, I actually had a mentor, and I was just asking him, like, how should I expand on this project? What should I do next? And we actually came up with the idea of using machine learning to help, like, to add on to help identify which ones are ripe. So I actually wanted to do that this year. It's going to be a little bit harder because of the pandemic now, but I'm still planning on implementing that.
And when you say machine learning, are you talking about some kind of AI?
Yeah, so there's something called, I don't know if you know it, but there's something called neural networks, and it just, so it'll be able to identify if it receives an image or a video of a specific object, then it would be able to classify if it's ripe or unripe based on what you set it to be.
Magana and Soham, I wonder, you know, if both of you could talk about it, when you do your inventions, is this to, is it because of the competition, or would you be inventing this kind of stuff anyways? Soham?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. My invention journey actually started in the sixth grade with Invention Convention and Invention League. And from there, I've been inventing ever since. I think I've been creating inventions that kind of benefit society in some way, and that idea really interests me. And so if it even weren't for the competitions, I would invent them. But the competitions give me the resources and the opportunities to kind of push myself. Like in a lot of these competitions, you get feedback from professionals, and you're able to see what the judges are thinking of your idea. And also with the competitions, they push you to keep doing more and keep expanding on your project, because you're trying to work to this goal of getting a certain award or going somewhere to nationals or something like that. And I think both of them contribute to my interest and my passion in inventing.
I want to talk to you, Abby Fisher, too, but I want to get to Magana. What about you? I mean, would you be doing this anyways?
Yeah, for me, I think it's both. So this was actually the first year that I started inventing. But the main reason why I started was because of the competition. But now I think that due to that competition, I'll definitely start inventing on my own time more. So I think the competition is what initially sparked my interest.
Abby Fisher, it seems like what Soham and Magana are talking about are exactly what you want them to do. I mean, that's kind of, they're like hitting all, you know, checking all the boxes on the goal of the Ohio Invention League. What's the difference for people who are listening thinking, well, what about science fair? Why wouldn't they just do this? You know, that sounds like science fair, you know, if we remove the, you know, the the volcano. It just sounds like it's the same sort of thing. What's the difference?
Well, I think the unique thing about Invention Convention and our program is that Invention Convention is the place where these students are taking the skills that they are learning in, let's say, robotics classes, coding classes, and they're applying them to any problem that they are personally invested in. These students, you know, may take part in other programs, or they maybe have never done anything STEM or science related before, the kids in our program. But what they are creative and critical problem solvers who look around their world, activate their empathy, find a problem that is personal to them, that they are excited about, and then all those other STEM skills fall into place for the kids. So it's really the freedom that the kids have to isolate and choose any problem that they are interested in. And then they have the opportunity, now that they have a product that is unique and original, because that's another piece of this for the kids. They're thinking about something that is truly unique and innovative, and they have a product, and they now can start talking about entrepreneurship, a possible business, as Soham has referenced today, Magana as well. So, you know, I think those are the things that really help set our program apart. And right now there's a lot of talk about social emotional skills in learning. And so I think our program is a beautiful union of STEM skills applied and social emotional skills developed for these students.
And I think as Soham mentioned, the resources and the opportunity to interact with professionals in the STEM fields. How do you provide that? What kind of resources is he talking about, Abby?
Well, we are very fortunate to have support of a corporate sponsors and also just individuals who are invested in these kids. And so those professionals like Honda may invite our inventors to their Honda Heritage Museum. The research and development team can talk to them. We do mentoring calls for our students every month where they learn from, it can be an adult alumni of our program, because with our 28 year history, we have students that invented when they were young and are now adults, who are in jobs like color design and mechanical engineering. So they're consistently staying connected to us, learning from these industry experts and growing, and as well as AT&T. I mean, you know, Christopher Weich, who has been on all of these calls with the kids, very personally invites them and says, if I can help in any way, tell me how, and I will try and connect you to who you know. So it is a community effort, and it, these kids are really supported in the process.
Magana, I'm wondering what reaction you've gotten from fruit growers to your invention, what kind of feedback you're getting from the industry.
Yeah, so I haven't actually talked to anyone as of right now in the actual industry, but I'm guessing if I had to think about what they would say as a limitation on my project right now, there's a specific distance that the device needs to be away from the actual fruit, and that it's like a pretty close distance. It's probably less than a foot, a little. Mm-hmm. So if there's any way to make the distance be longer and be effective from further away, that would be really great.
It to scale it up, in other words.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what about you, Soham? What kind of feedback are you getting from people who immediately could use this device?
Yeah, I think it's all been positive feedback so far. We've contacted some sign language organizations in Ohio and around the world. And the feedback that we've gotten is always been that this is something that can be easily accessible to a lot of people. And it's not as cost prohibitive as some of the other current measures in place to help people learn sign language. Like when we were researching, we found that there is some other technology or things like support service providers who can help people learn sign language, but they're not readily accessible to all people. And often they can be pretty expensive. And so the main feedback that we've gotten is this is something that's unique from the market and that hasn't really been explored before. And it's something that we hope to continue in the future.
And I'm wondering from both of you, when you do something like this, do you start to see this like all kinds of other things out there? I mean, does it grow other ideas in you, Magana?
For me, I've been thinking about where I could go about it. But recently, actually, I read about the Time Kid of the Year for 2020. And her project was actually very similar. I would say it had an even larger, like a larger outreach that it could have done. So it had like a lot more clout around it. But so I want to find ways to make mine grow even more, because her project was kind of similar to mine. It just had a really large problem today. So I went to address mine to a larger problem.
Okay. Yeah. And what about you, Soham?
Yeah, I think through this process, actually, the way we came up with the idea of sign language, or where we actually heard of it, was last year in the 9th and 10th grade. So currently I'm in 11th grade. In the 9th and 10th grade, I worked on my friend, and we worked on a project to help people who had dyslexia. And during that research is where we kind of found this idea of sign language, and we said, okay, we might pursue it in the future. And then a year later, we ended up pursuing it. So I think the research and the inventions that I'm doing, it has led me to learn a lot more about the things that are around me and explore different fields.
Magana Boda, high school freshman at Olentangy High School, inventor of Bright Ripe. She will represent Ohio at the National Convention of the National Kid Invention Day. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Soham Joshi, he is a high school junior at Columbus Academy. He's an inventor of a robotic glove that can teach sign language. He'll represent the state at the national convention as well. Thanks for joining us. I really appreciate your time, Soham.
Thank you.
And Abby Fisher, programming director for the Ohio Invention League. Thanks for your time as well. Thanks for bringing the kids to us.
Thank you. Thank you, Anne, for having us on today and celebrating the amazing innovation that these two inventors are doing and all of Ohio's K-12 inventors. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stand by and stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The annual Consumer Electronics Show is online this year. Russell Holley is contributing editor for Android Central, and he's covering the CES as always. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So we've talked about this a couple times in recent weeks. The show is usually in Las Vegas, viva la, but not this year. What's it been like to experience it virtually?
You've been in a Zoom meeting before, right, Ann?
Yes.
So it's 3,000 of those.
That's horrible.
And that's the whole week. we have a lot of meetings planned with a lot of things that would normally be here, touch this thing and you know, experience this thing. And then unfortunately, you know, no ability to touch those things. So a little limited. It has opened the doors for several companies to talk more about concept products that don't have a physical thing for people to walk up and touch. BMW, for example, just recently announced their prototype for a flying car, which sounds, you know, kind of fantastical and spectacular. They wouldn't have done this at a normal consumer electronics show because there obviously wouldn't be a prototype there for someone to climb inside of and get a picture. Instead, they have these renders that they can show how they would make this work and why it would be a thing that BMW would care about in the future. So there's a little more in the way of kind of future thinking, which is kind of exciting and less, you know, here's a product that you can put in your hands. But for someone who wakes up every day and gets excited about putting things in his hands, a little disappointing.
Yeah. And I think about those kinds of scenes that you talk about with CES. I can visualize it because I've been to conventions and things like that before. There is something lost in translation when you're not walking and letting your natural, you know, senses draw you to something.
That's correct. Yeah. Being able to touch something enables me to, you know, kind of think about, you know, questions that I would ask in particular when it comes to kind of consumer electronics, when I am then thinking about the weight of the thing and how, yeah, you know, how often someone would want to use it, especially now that we're talking about, you know, kind of wearable technology, things that people are going to be wearing on their faces and on their heads. You know, the things like weight and durability are often questions that cannot simply be answered over video chat.
All right. So I'm just wondering, I mean, this is just one year. It might go to next year. We don't know. I mean, at this point, how the pandemic plays out in real time when it comes to these. This is a huge undertaking that they've been doing for years with CES in Las Vegas. Thousands and thousands of people go to it. Do you think there's any short-term, because long-term's too hard to tell, but any short-term impact on kind of technology writ large because of this?
I think the short-term is going to significantly impact small businesses that normally come to CES with a short idea that they're looking for funding on.
Okay.
What you typically, there's often an entire wing of the Las Vegas Convention Center that is dedicated to these you know, kind of prototype ideas, where this is, you know, kind of the only version of this product that someone has made in the hopes that someone will walk by and you know, think that the idea is good enough to request funding. It's really hard to get someone's attention. Someone like me, you know, in an event like this where there's just so much noise from all of these larger companies that are doing things, I do have some concerns about smaller companies that would normally, you know, kind of bank everything on and gamble on an event like that. There's just not an equivalent that can be done, you know, virtually.
All right. So let's talk about what is out there. LG is partnering with Google to bring a cloud gaming service to its televisions. What's going on here?
This is really exciting. So Google's Stadia platform it allows you to play PC games on either your phone or your computer browser or your television. But the television component is up until now only if you had Google's special Chromecast. You pay the $50 for this little puck and you plug it into the back of your television and you buy the extra controller that Google sells and then you go and you play that. LG and Google have actually now partnered so that you don't need that little extra puck that goes to the back of the television anymore. The software actually runs on the television itself because all of LG's TVs now are smart TVs. And so there's a software update running out to LG's smart televisions that'll make it so that instead of buying an Xbox or instead of buying a PlayStation, you just get the controller. You spend the $45 or $50 on the controller that you want. You connect it to the television, and then you have access to these games. It's an interesting step forward in that it removes kind of the big expensive part of playing video games for a lot of people is that $400 to $500 console.
Except for the people that make those consoles. Is that like the new buggy whip?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be an interesting thing over the next year is you know, whether it's going to be the range between people who are very excited about an individual game and they want to play and people who are very excited about every night sitting down and playing games for a while. Because I think when it comes to kind of what we think about the hardcore gamer, someone who wants to have the Xbox and wants to have the PlayStation, you know, to make sure that they have the latest games with the best graphics and, you know, kind of at the top of the line, everything, those people are going to continue to spend $400 and $500 when a new console comes out. But someone like my brother-in-law is going to get really excited about Cyberpunk 2077 and not really be excited about too many other games. And so if you give that person the ability to spend $50 on the game and have it just exist on their television, and they play the game and then they're done and they don't play another game for another couple of months, that kind of person is going to be significantly more interested in a service like Stadia than they are in buying a new console every couple of years.
It only works on LG TVs?
Currently, it only works on LG's smart television platform. With LG's success, a lot of the other companies typically follow. It would not surprise me to see Samsung and Sony make similar announcements either later in the year or coming into next year. And the same goes with some of the more budget-friendly smart televisions. It would not surprise me if the next line of, say, Vizio smart televisions included a similar feature. And this is going to be a really big push for Google's Stadia platform if that trend continues.
And so this is a deal. This is a done deal.
This is it. LG software will start updating within the next month. And as long as you have a controller that can connect to the LG TV, it does not have to be Google's Stadia controller, but it can be. Uh-huh. As long as you have that controller, then you will be able to immediately start playing games through the internet platform that is Stadia.
Okay, so TCL is making something that some people might think is right up there with the flying car, a phone that rolls up when you're not using it. Okay. Why?
Yeah, that's it. That's the end of the thought. So, you know, we have had this conversation for a couple of years now, Anne, where phones have been getting bigger. They've been mm-hmm. getting taller. They've been getting wider. There's a ton of research that says that a lot of people consume a majority of their media on their screens when they're commuting, when they're sitting at lunch, you know, in a bunch of different scenarios. The larger screen allows them to watch more YouTube. It allows them to consume more TikTok. It allows them to watch movies, you know, do a lot of things on their phones. So there's a benefit to making these phones larger, but it also still kind of sucks to walk around and use this giant phone. Like, it's inconvenient to use with one hand in a lot of cases. We actually have an entire cottage industry of special accessories that clip onto the back of our phones now to make it easier to hold these phones because they are too big to hold with one hand.
Uh-huh.
You know, so this idea has been around for a while now, these kind of flexible displays. LG did this with a television a couple of years ago where, you know, what if the television just disappeared into the floor and just rolled out when someone wanted to do that? And a lot of folks saw that and said, well, how cool would it be to do that with my phone or with my tablet, where it would just take up less space until I needed that additional space? And so that's what we've seen, not just from LG, but from TCL as well, where the screen expands when you ask it to. In the case of LG and TCL both, it only expands by about an inch and a half right now. But you press that button to go and use kind of the larger screen, and your screen goes from this kind of smaller phone. It kind of slowly rolls out. And then you have this, what was a 5-inch phone is now a 7-inch phone, which would make watching movies and you know, surfing on the internet a little more convenient when you are sitting down and doing that. And I think as a concept, that could potentially be very exciting for people who are, you know, where the majority of what they're doing with their phone is either sitting stationary or, you know, kind of walking around and risking dropping their phone.
I'm trying to visualize what this looks like. I'm not
fortunately
succeeding.
There's a if you head to the LG press announcement, or if you head to Android Central, there is actually a small video of this in action, where it kind of expands and contracts. The LG version expands horizontally, where the TCL version expands vertically, which means that the LG version, you have a phone that is, you know, kind of generally phone shaped, and when you push the button, it grows to be kind of the size of a tablet. And I think for a lot of people, this is more palatable than the phones that Samsung has been working on, where they fold in half or they kind of fold out because even when the phone, even when the LG phone is completely collapsed, it's not that much larger than it was before. Whereas the Samsung phones, when you fold them in half, it is two halves of a large phone that have been folded in half. So now it's kind of bulky and doesn't fit super well in your pocket. So yeah, I see that being kind of the immediate benefit is people who want the bigger screen, but also, you know, don't want a phone that is giant in their pocket.
So is the material stretching out or is it un?
No. What's really happening here is that this is a screen that wraps up. So it's actually just, there's a whole bunch of screen that you're not using all of the time. And then when you want to use it, that extra screen kind of rolls out and then gets turned on.
Okay.
So that all of that screen is there all the time. It's not stretching so much as it's hard to think about, but it's like a newspaper. It's actually rolling up behind the back of the phone.
Okay. All right. It's not cheap.
It is not. No, when these phones actually come out, they are going to start at around $1,500 and they are likely going to grow from there as we focus on things like, quality and making sure that they can survive impacts. Some will remember that the very first versions of the foldable screens had a lot of dust ingress problems, which caused the first versions of them to actually almost be recalled. So there's going to be a lot of kind of wait and see to determine. This is another one of those things where it would be really great to be able to touch this thing and
yeah,
see,
right.
Like, you know, if there's any kind of damage or noticeable use over time. But yeah, this particular thing could potentially be very interesting for the future of how we think about phones and screen sizes and things like that.
I have so many more questions about that, but I guess I'm just going to have to wait and see what it does. Lenovo is making a set of glasses. They're smart glasses for businesses. What do these do?
Yeah, so what Lenovo has here, they're calling the Think Reality A3 glasses. And these are glasses that are designed to work pretty similarly to some of the technology we've seen from Microsoft and its HoloLens platform, in that it's got, you know, these kind of glasses bit that are down kind of where your eyes are. And then above it, there's a set of cameras. And the set of cameras are kind of taking, picture maps of the world around you and allowing you to place, kind of digital assets on the walls. So imagine sitting down at your desk and where the screens are in front of you right now, where your monitor is sitting there and kind of your notes and things like that. Instead of having a physical monitor, you just put these glasses on and the screen was just floating there and was there for you to interact with. That's the kind of experience that these companies have been aiming for a little while now. And for corporate environments, it could be the difference between having someone be able to prototype on a large space versus a small space. For example, we've seen a lot of companies, automotive companies, for example, where they have people who can put these glasses on and they can now design parts of a car without actually having to, actually go and touch things. And they can go and walk into these spaces instead of having to look at a two-dimensional screen. It gives them a lot more flexibility from a 3D perspective, which could be very interesting. But to be clear, not the kind of thing that we're going to be using at home anytime soon. This is definitely right. Just kind of a corporate America kind of thing.
Yeah, and corporate America, what is your sense about how they'll embrace this?
We've seen a lot of companies, in particular auto manufacturers, try to embrace this. Anyone who does any kind of large-scale design, where this has become an increasingly popular way to prototype things, because it is in many ways less expensive than, kind of having massive 3D printers create versions of things over and over and over again. If you can do it, digitally, and you can walk around and see things and then kind of design something in a physical space once, it ends up long-term being less expensive. So these have the potential to be really interesting for those kind of industries, but we're still a long ways away from this kind of technology being something that we use at home.
Russell Holley, really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holley is contributing editor for Android Central. We've been talking about the Consumer Electronics Show and what's jumped out at him, at least in a virtual way, since the CES is virtual this year. Thanks so much for listening today. It's been Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.